Yeah.
All right, so we'll get started. Topic tonight is fasting, specifically perhaps as pertinent to women. We'll discuss a lot of issues because it's really non-specific. The reasons why women generally don't fast, or the women who don't fast, I should say, don't fast, may have to do with things that theoretically could be to a degree applicable to men. And the nature of the fast day as a whole. So we'll try to define the fast days and the different types of fast days and see if it's applicable. And a few things that we'll address, hopefully, if we have enough time, are firstly, why do we still keep the Tanaisim that we keep nowadays? Global picture, because we'll see from the Gemara it's not so clear that it's necessary to keep them in today's day and age. Number two, dealing with pregnant and nursing women, and women who theoretically could be nursing but are choosing not to nurse. So what is their responsibility, if any, with fasting? And perhaps we'll touch upon also people who are sick, what's their responsibility when fasting? And then there is a minhag, which in case we don't get to it, I do want to say that I'm not a fan of, which is in certain communities, some women don't fast at all. And it has nothing to do with whether they are nursing or pregnant or just had a baby or what have you. Even an 18-year-old girl who's not married would, you know, not fast in these communities.
Never fast.
Never fast. And, So when I say that, I mean with the exception of Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av. Thank you for having me clarify. These are issues that we have to address. Perhaps we'll have a limud schus for those people. At the same time, I do not advocate such a minhag. And if somebody does have that custom, I would recommend actually that the women should fast unless they fall within another one of the categories which we're more comfortable with, that they would not necessarily have to fast. So that we have to define. Mirza Shem, the reason I make this was, you know, we're coming up on Shavuos Matamos. A couple years ago, I remember walking out of Shul, I believe it was on Tisha B'Av, I don't remember exactly, I think it was Tisha B'Av. If not, it was one of the Tanaisim that, unfortunately, as most of our Tanaisim, with the exception of Yom Kippur and Tainus Esther, they commemorate events that are less than joyous. And the person said to me, and I'm going to assume it was Tisha B'Av, but fill in the blanks of the other one. If it was, he said, Mirza Hashem, you know, you won't have Tisha B'Av next year. So I said to him, I said, I'd like to have Tisha B'Av next year, just not with all the Avelis and the fast. I'd like to make it there, you know. The day in the calendar, hopefully I'll make it there. And thank God I did. Unfortunately, we are still mourning. And hopefully that will change. The Pasuk in Zechariah, we're taught that the Tanaisim that do commemorate events of mourning and destruction in the future will be turned into joyous days. So even though we will, no matter what, as a nation, certainly have Shavuos or Matamos in about a week, but we hope that it will be, as Zechariah points out, a day of joy and festivities instead of the way it's been in the past. So hopefully tonight's learning will be just for Zechus Limud Torah, and will not have practical halachic application. But if it does, then it's a good idea. And obviously, any kind of personal situation, you know, discuss your personal situation. Don't necessarily learn from Klalim, as we're discussing here this evening.
So,
I don't know if we'll get into Nidche today. I don't know if we're going to have time for that. We'll see. So,
is it proper to burn kinos books at the end of Tisha B'Av, or that's just a... I've heard of it. I mean, what exactly is the attitude? But I mean,
it's a level of confidence. It's not the minhag in Or Simcha. Or Simcha doesn't own kinos books. They've never been donated or anything like that. So people do bring their own. One thing I would be aware is generally there are shemos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Pesukim that are found in Kinos books, and therefore I would recommend that that they not be burned from that reason. But other than that, if it doesn't have that type of thing, and you know, one assumes that they don't have kedusha to them, which is arguable, then it's just a very significant level of confidence. Okay, so you know, the fast days, as we have had them, displays, you know, we've said, I'm not talking about Tisha B'Av in Yom Kippur, they display elements of mourning, and there is an isser to eat or drink. Now, we know on Tisha B'Av in Yom Kippur, there are other isurim that one has. One is not allowed to smear oil on themselves, wear leather shoes, or tashmish shemitah. Those don't apply to these other fasts, and the question is, why not? It seems from the Gemara in Tainus and elsewhere that a real Tainus Tzibur has all the Chamish Inuim. Additionally, the Tainus is supposed to start from the night before, by all means. That seems to be the Pashas in the Sugya. Yet we have, with the exception of Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, we don't start our Tanesim until Alos HaShachar, however that's defined. So, we see that, understood, there are many minhagim of Tisha B'Av that deal with specifically Ta'avilas that are independent of the five Inuyim and starting the night before. At the same point in time, from the Gemara itself, we see with regard to these five Inuyim, I'm not talking about, you know, longer clothes and things like that, which deal with the 9 days, with the Shavuot Shacholo, and things on Tisha B'Av and other minhagim we have. I'm not talking about those, but they actually assume that we have L'chaira, they should apply to all the fast days. So the question is, why don't they? And the minute is that they don't. If one opens up a Mishnah Berurah, you may find that some people are a little bit makbid on some of these items, not to do them. You know, rechitza would be an issue, also cleaning oneself, certainly with hot water. And even, you know, without perhaps, you know, one has to address why are these things mutter. So the Gemara comes out with, and it seems the way we've shown mass take it, is that there are really three time periods that have to be addressed. One time period is a time when there's active persecution of Klal Yisrael, and there's real churban present, not just that the Beis HaMikdash unfortunately is still destroyed, which is a churban, but at the same point in time, but there's something active that is, you know, really persecuting Klal Yisrael as a whole. Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately with the Zechuyos, hopefully we won't need these Yisurim, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu has decided throughout our history that many parts of Klal Yisrael have been persecuted throughout the generations at any given point in time, and even nowadays there are hardships for certain Jews living in certain regions. And that, nevertheless, doesn't qualify as Klal Yisrael as a whole, per se, being persecuted in the degree that we've had, literally when they were being Zeris on the entirety of the nation, or the Churban on the entire nation, such as the Beis HaMikdash being destroyed, Ben Koziba's rebellion being suppressed, other time periods like that. So we have Churban, we have persecution, if you will. That's one time period. Then we have another time period when everything is completely shalom in the world. Nothing bad is happening. Unfortunately, that really doesn't happen either. And then we have a time period which is...
Has it ever happened in history? Is it David?
Yeah, Lechor, yes. Shlomo. It has happened, Shlomo. Yeah. You know, David, perhaps. Even in the second Beis HaMikdash, there may have been times when they didn't fast certain Tanesim. Keep in mind, some of our Tanesim, such as Tisha B'Av, are somewhat applicable, even coming from the first Beis HaMikdash. Right? So, during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, it doesn't seem that they kept Tisha B'Av. Right. Because there was a built Beis HaMikdash. There was whatever the definition of Shalom is, it was enough. They felt, similar to those Pesukim in Zechariah that we were discussing a few moments ago, that they were days of festivities. Now, do we have recorded they were actual days of festivities? Not necessarily. I don't know if we have that in, from the second Beis HaMikdash. I don't believe they're recorded in Miglos Tainus. We know La'asablavo, that, you know, that pasuk seems to be describing such an event occurring. But until that time, so we're kind of in between, where we're not fully persecuted, Baruch Hashem. At the same time, it's not 100% shalom. And therefore, what we have, seems to the Gemara, leaves open, as we shalom take, it's kind of up to us. It's open-ended, a little degree. We get to choose. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that, this year I'm gonna do it, next year not, Shabbos Petam is this year is a pretty tough one for those of us in the Northern Hemisphere. You know, things are so early, it's really a very long day. I don't know how different it is than, let's say, last year, a few weeks difference, we're talking maybe a difference of 20 minutes or so, I don't know. But we're really going to be, hopefully, celebrating Shabbos Petam in about a week, at really the longest, essentially the longest time period of the year, the longest days. So, should I say that? Kind of tough for me. Obviously, as we're all smiling as I say that, no, the answer is no. Why not?
Is this like a den of a minhag now?
We'll have to get to that. No. Now, the Ramban is the one who's really quoted, for the most part, to be the one who determined his interpretation of this Gemara, so to speak, is really what is taken by the Poskim. The Ramban wrote many Svarim, besides his Chidushim on Torah, and his Drashos, which are somewhat popular also in his Chidushim on Shas. So he has several other Svarim, one of which is called Teres Adam, which talks about Minhagi Avelus, which is a primary sefer when learning Hilchos Avelus. Additionally, dealing with Avelus and fasting, this can be found in Teres Adam. In Teres Adam, he describes this issue that we're addressing. And he says that, essentially, it really, a real fast, it's an all-or-nothing type of a deal. However, Klal Yisrael, because we're in this middle time period, it's a little open-ended. And therefore, it all depends on what people want to do. It's come to a point where Klal Yisrael has accepted, and we've accepted, his lashon seems to indicate that Klal Yisrael as a whole, like you're saying, somewhat minhag, has accepted that we fast. But, because we're at this in-between stage, so it's determined based on our acceptance. Now, one could have heard that our acceptance won't create a new type of fast. But we see practically the Jewish people are nohag in such a fashion. And therefore, the Ramban says that's obviously what's going on. So what happened essentially was, we have accepted upon ourselves, as the Jewish people, to fast. However, we have not accepted upon ourselves to fast from the night before. We only do it from the day. We have not accepted upon ourselves the other inuyim. We've only accepted upon ourselves eating and drinking. Now, if a person wants to be machmir, is there room to do so? So as we've mentioned, that latter person do mention, yes, there is room to do so. At the same point in time, because Klal Yisrael has accepted it, now it's become like a din d'rabbanan. Now, when you think about that, especially within the realm of Tanaisim, it's a very powerful, powerful concept. The entirety of Torah Shebaal Peh, as determined essentially by Shas, whatever that is, and I know we've touched upon this a few times, certainly in Shavuos morning, I know who was at the shir, I was barely there, I was there physically, but the focal point of why Shas is binding, and the way it's binding, and the subsequent interpretations of Shas that are now certainly binding, is because the Jewish people have accepted its authority. And the Jewish people, meaning those who have accepted the authority of the Sanhedrin originally, when the Sanhedrin, unfortunately, was abolished in Mirz Hashem, it should be reestablished soon, but when it was, so the nation followed the successors, who essentially were the Amoraim, and then the Gaonim, and then, unfortunately, there was no real central body anymore. Even in the times of the Gaonim, it wasn't essential. Even in the times of the Amoraim, it wasn't a real central body. But because Rav Ashi his compilation, which was meant to be more of an encyclopedia, as Rashi says. And then, subsequently, the Gaonim gave extra clothing, besides a few of the ones that were originally there, of Hadapaskin. So during that time period, really, instead of a pluralistic way that I pass them like this, Rev, you pass them like this, Rev, which we are very commonly doing in today's day and age, where, you know, this person passes like Rav Shlomo Zalman, or this person passes like Rav Moshe, or this person, because he's the Talmud of him, and he's the Talmud of him. So you had where things became really unified to a degree, and that became binding, because Klal Yisrael, for the most part, accepted that, and whatever they did, they did, and whatever they didn't, perhaps, was still left for debate amongst the Gaonim and the Rishonim. But that's major, that major body of work was then accepted. That's why we have to keep it. That's how the Rambam describes it, and that seems to be logically why it is. Tanaisim would be the same thing. If all of Klal Yisrael has accepted this, then that's what the Jewish nation does. And if you don't, then you're not acting like the people of the Jewish nation. Now, when it comes to somebody who's a classic Purish Min HaTzibur, it means he's not following and keeping and adhering to the needs of the Tzibur, and not just needs, but he's not acting like a Jew and not feeling a part of the Jewish nation. One of the classic examples given by Rashi and others is that when there's an Eis Tzara, he doesn't join in. He doesn't feel that he's attached to the rest of the Jewish people. He feels he's an individual who may happen to be Jewish genetically, if you will, and therefore, since he's not attached to the Jewish people, he separates himself from them. Now, understood, these tzaras for which we're mourning were still feeling the repercussions. Unfortunately, we still don't have a Beis HaMikdash, the siege for the city, whatever we're going to be discussing, the breach of the walls for Shavuos or B'Tammuz, these things haven't been repaired, and one thing led to the other, to the ultimate Churban of the Bayis. Nevertheless, if, you know, we're not really, so to speak, calling out to Hashem as a tzara that things shouldn't befall us, that the walls get breached, they're already happening. It's somewhat mourning what occurred with a recognition that it is an ace tzara, because since that day was prone for bad things to happen in the past, although we might not see anything right now happening on that specific day, the Jewish nation has determined that this is a commemorative of mourning, and I don't mean just specifically commemorate, just to think about. It's really to relive, so to speak, that what occurred. We recognize that we're going through that again to a degree, and it is as if it's an Eis Tzara, and if a person doesn't feel that, and doesn't feel the pains of this nation, not just those who are alive today either, the nation is encompassed of everybody who has ever been part of this nation and will be part of this nation. The Tzibur is timeless. That being the case, and they're acting as if they're not Jewish, and therefore they need to be mitzdarif with the Tzibur be'ez tzarasam. So that's a very important thing to recognize. The Tzibur has determined what the fasts are and how to fast them. As I mentioned, this is not applicable to Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, but the other ones it is. And because they've determined it in this fashion, that is the tzura of a fast day. Okay, so
that would suggest that one can, the Chai Yisrael, if they wanted to, can establish a new fast.
That is correct.
If Chai Yisrael feels like I'm for, let's say, Churban Europa in the last, if Chai Yisrael can adopt upon themselves, we want to fast today for the follow, for the...
Now, there are two things that need to be addressed when instituting a new fast. One is, if it's done, is it legally binding? And the answer is yes. The second is it something that we should do? Meaning, even if it's legally binding, doesn't mean that it should be done. Hashkafically, halachically. Whereas if it were to be done, then it would be done. Now, that has been a matter of debate. I don't believe anybody has ever really tried to institute a fast day for it, per se. Although, obviously, Yom HaShoah is at least recognized by many as a commemorative day, and that's something that has been debated both in the political arena and in the halachic arena, and you know, one can make his judgment of that, but it wasn't determined as a fast day anyway. Should there be a fast day, it could be binding. We find on a smaller level, when a person is living in a community,
He has to be a member of that community. If not, he doesn't see himself as part of a tzibur. I'm not talking about the greater Jewish people. I'm talking about if people live in a specific city, they have to see themselves as part of that city. And if they are not mitzarif to the tzarchi tzibur of that city, country, whatever it is that's necessary as they participate in, as a member of that, then they're also parish from the tzibur.
Is it the Vater Bunim established? We want to make a fast day for the following tzarchis in our town.
So, I don't want to use the argument of the Vater Bunim specifically, perhaps at Baltimore, because then we would have to get into whether or not the Vater Bunim, what powers they have and what powers they don't have, which I'm definitely not going to get into, certainly not with this thing being recorded. But whatever there is, and I'm not saying they don't have power, I'm also not saying they do have power necessarily, but if you have a city that accepts upon it a tainus, it's binding, and we find that. We find certain areas fasted Chaf Sivan for the atrocities that occurred. You know, we're talking years ago, and they were tremendous massacres. Rahman Itzlan, you know, hopefully there should never be something like that again. Unfortunately, since then, there have been worse massacres. You're just mentioning, obviously, with the Holocaust. You know, it's been very tragic, our history. And there have been many times when specific communities have adopted different customs for that. Now, once one no longer lives in that community, then we can address, if one comes from a community and is no longer part of that community because he's moved elsewhere, what's binding of the minhagim that he took from his old city, and what of the new city, and what are his children and their children supposed to keep? That's a totally different shir. At the same point in time, at least there's precedent that if you're living in a city and that city happens to have a fast day, Baltimore does not have any that I'm aware of, so then one has to participate in that fast, because otherwise he's parished from that mini tzibur. Is he parished from Klal Yisrael? No, it's not necessarily as severe as being parished from Klal Yisrael, whereas somebody who's not keeping these tanesim is parished from Mamish, the tzibur of Klal Yisrael, who has accepted these tanesim to commemorate nationalistic, and I don't mean that in a political sense, I mean the nation of Yisrael, all the events that we commemorate on these tanesim that we do are things that affect the entire B'nai Yisrael. So those things, you know, by one not participating, is showing a tremendous lack of respect and care and really being a person of the community of Klal Yisrael as a whole. So, just to go now to that minhag, which I wasn't so happy with and I'm still not so happy with, but then at least to give a limud schus for it, because you know it's not a good idea to be judgmental people, and the reason I'm only saying that I'm not happy with it is if somebody happens to, you know, have this and they'll listen to me, which is two very big things, then I would advocate not keeping that, and that is some women don't fast at all.
I've never heard of this word.
In certain Hasidic communities.
Yeah.
I've suspected, although I don't have proof, and I'm not saying this in a negative way at all, that the minhag developed because, as we'll see, we're relatively makil when it comes to nursing women and pregnant women, and some people have even been makil, women who have children that they're raising and are having very difficult times. I don't know if we'll get into that specific case now or not, but nevertheless, if you deal with communities that historically have pretty large families, the women get married pretty young and are having babies until they're older already, and the educational system for women wasn't certainly structured, and oftentimes, you know, the women kind of just did certain things but really didn't participate as much as in other communities. So it lends itself to a woman really at age 15 when she got married, not fasting until she's maybe mid-40s, and her children seeing their mother never fasting because of all the other tzeirufim that we've been talking about may have assumed, just like women don't participate in many other things, in certain communities the women rarely went to shul. We find, forgetting about Hasidic communities I'm talking about, you find that in early poskim discussions about things like that, they may not have attended shul very frequently, they may not have attended all sorts of other things that was considered that's the men's department, so that can allow itself for this. And I'm not being negative in any way. Every community, every element of class, those things that culturally developed, And it's not to be taken lightly either, per se. At the same point in time, I suspect that that's a strong reason why this began to take off more. However, there is a limud schos that we could say, and that is, although the Ramban seems pretty clear that all of Klal Yisrael accepted this, he makes no exception for women, we find, from the Rosh HaGosashri a little bit, really, that the lashon used makes it seem almost as if it was community by community. And therefore, if subsequent communities as a whole would decide they don't want to fast it, then they theoretically would be able to give it up. As I said, the Ramban does not seem to say this at all. And there is, I think, very strong weight to going with that, because once Klal Yisrael accepts something for one community to step out, we don't find precedent, but there's, you know, jurisdiction, if you will, for the Rabbanim of that city to opt out once all Klal Yisrael has something. Nevertheless, the Rush seems to indicate a little bit something on this, you know, in this vein. It's not so clear also, which is why I wouldn't be sameich on it. And therefore, it's possible that they opted to have the women not have to fast, because, in general, all the reasons that we'll talk about were reasons for Peturim, and since anyway for a good portion they wouldn't be, and to have them available for other things that they may want to take care of or need to take care of, I should really say. So it could be that just as a minig, it developed that they did not fast, and that may have present that they don't need to. How can you split the fast? The same way we split the fast. We split it that we don't keep all five inuyim. We split it that we only start from daybreak. And the Ramban says, because it's all tali in the minhag that we've adapted. So since we've adapted, if you would say this, you'd say that those communities adapted a minhag that excluded the women from needing to participate in the fast, and therefore they wouldn't have to. As I said, you know, even the Lashon of the Rosh, I'm not sure really, or Agos Ashri, excuse me, is really allowing for this. I also don't see the mechanism, you know, as the Rush may be in disagreement with the Ramban, that the Ramban is saying that all of Klal Yisrael already accepted it. The fact that the Poskim seems to really address the Ramban as the authority, I don't see the mechanism that would allow a community to opt out once you already an established minhag of all of Klal Yisrael. And therefore, I do not advocate that heter. In fact, I strongly would recommend not keeping that, meaning that the women should fast. However, there are certain things that need to be addressed, and there are certain things that have changed over time. If one opens the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, one will find it, and I'm not talking about Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur at this point in time, but the other Tanesim, one will find, not talking about Tanes Esther either, I'm talking about the four Tanesim, one will find that pregnant women and nursing mothers, it's really only if they're having a very difficult time fasting that they're allowed to break their fast. Now, most poskim in today's day and age, I should say most, a significant portion of poskim in today's day and age, don't even think twice and tell nursing mothers and pregnant women that they do not have to fast. And the reason is, and we do find precedent from many poskim going back a little bit, that we find practically in today's day and age, people are weaker. Now, is it psychological? Is it reality? I'm not sure, but the way it is true is we do find people do seem to have a difficult time. You know, back then, they were more accustomed to more physical labor in general, and they were more accustomed to things not being as easy. Does that mean that there's any physical thing that they can't really endure? I'm not sure, but it definitely feels harder for the average person to go through and endure these types of things. And therefore, pregnant and nursing women, you know, in general, do not fast. Certainly these for Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur are a different story, and we're not going to be discussing that now. The definition of a nursing mother and of a pregnant woman needs to be really defined. Pregnancy in the times of Chazal was defined as when the fetus, or it's not even the fetus because you're not actually seeing the fetus, but when the woman's stomach is, she's starting to show, what we say nowadays, she's showing, which is at 3 months on average into a pregnancy, she'll begin to show. So what about a woman who prior to 3 months? Now, Chazal seem to intertwine the fact that these women are not seeing their regular dam nida, and the fact that their guf has changed, that that the chalishos haguf, if you will, the weakness that occurs, is I don't think it's necessarily cause and effect, but a vorea misbarkin, that's going to be really with the birth for nursing. But we see the two go hand in hand. A woman is considered by Chazal to be mesulekes damim, to no longer have blood, so to speak, or a regular cycle, after 3 months, once the uber is hukar ubra, when she's showing. Now, there are ramifications, major ramifications for vestos, you know, woman calculating when she should be seeing, if she has a vest kavua, which is not so common, and also for fasting. If a woman is between just literally becoming pregnant and 3 months. So, it's applicable to both vestos and to fasting. We're going to only address fasting this evening. Obviously, today's day and age, you know, with tests, a woman can know with pretty good certainty that she's pregnant even before 3 months of not having seen dam nida. So we're not going to talk about her vestos tonight, but for this, so they're already, you know, unless she's really having a difficult time, we try to advocate fasting, but she should be aware of what's going on if it's still within the first 3 months. Obviously, and this goes without saying, a person should always speak to his or her doctor beforehand, certainly if there's any complications or anything like that. None of what I'm saying is on the table whatsoever. These things are very different in that case, and everybody's personal situation should be discussed with a competent medical professional before doing anything. That goes also with medications and things like that, and even things people shouldn't just say, oh, what's the big deal if I skip a day? Every so often anyway, forget it and I skip a day of, you know, things that people might not think are important. Blood pressure medication, all sorts of other things are very important. So I just need to say that, especially since we're being taped. You know, I'm assuming none of you here are pregnant. You know, that being the case, it is a very important thing that somebody speak about their personal situation. Nevertheless, so within the first 3 months, we try to be machmer, but there is precedent if it is very difficult. After 3 months, certainly, you know, the veld, for the most part, is not going to be machmer. When it comes to after she's had the child, so, you know, some women nurse for, let's say, a year. Some women don't nurse at all. They choose to, you know, bottle feed. And, you know, some women will nurse more than a year. In the times of Chazal, they seem to say that the norm for nursing was 2 years. Now, the issue at hand isn't so much the nursing, as Chazal say, it's that the going through labor was such an effect on her body that it takes 2 years for her to recover. And therefore, she's considered misulekes damim for 2 years, as if she doesn't bleed, for 2 years, and she's considered to be having chalishos haguf for 2 years. And that's even if she's not nursing. Chazal even discussed, for Chaman and Slan, the person loses the baby. So there's certainly no nursing going on. It still applies for 2 years. So we see that this chalishos haguf is associated for 2 years. Now, there are some poskim who say this, because it's in the early poskim that discussed for 2 years, she's considered a nursing mother, even if she's chosen not to nurse by choice or not by choice. It doesn't matter. If she's not nursing, she's still halachically a nursing mother because she's gone through labor, and that was, you know, very, you know, traumatic on her body. Certainly, you know, this is irrelevant whether it was natural or a C-section. Either way is considered a labor that, you know, would be traumatic on the body in this fashion.
Other surgeries would not apply then?
No.
Specifically to childbirth.
Correct. It talks about Avera Misparkin, and that also seems to, that, you know, her limbs, the way it happens, whatever it is, the process, Chazal understood it, that, you know, it has this chalishos haguf that it takes her this long to recover, and they attributed, once again, I'm not sure it's cause and effect per se, Gemara seems to discuss how things are working a little bit, but whatever it is the two things that happen are she's mesulekes damim, she's not going to be seeing her cycle regularly, and she'll also have this chalisha sagov. Nowadays, most women, if not all, shortly after stopping nursing, or if they didn't nurse at all, will start to see blood on a fairly regular cycle. You know, it'll go back to normal. You know, whatever the woman is accustomed to seeing, it usually goes back to that or something similar to that. It's very rare that a woman has a very set cycle nowadays. It's all averages. So, you know, let's say the average is once a month, she'll get her cycle. So it'll still be like once a month, whatever it is. So that causes a lot of Rabbanim to say that whatever is going on doesn't seem to be what Chazal understood. We can't attribute the Chalisha Saguf if we're not seeing the other simen of it, which is that she's not, you know, bleeding. She is bleeding. So that being the case, it's much more rare to find Rabbanim who will matir a woman who is not nursing, even though her child is within 2 years of age. There are some Rabbanim who do, but most seem to say that it's better for her to fast. However, once again, if a woman is having a harder time, or there are other factors, it's something certainly that a Rav is going to consider, because he knows that there are other opinions that even Lechatchila say she shouldn't be, but nevertheless, certainly, you know, off the bat, assuming there's no other complications and she's in otherwise good health, most would advocate that she should try to fast from the start.
Are there different levels of nursing?
Doesn't seem to.
As long as you're once a day, you're waiting on whatever it is, as long as it still happens.
As long as she's still nursing, correct. So, the next we get to is a chola, somebody who's sick. Somebody who's sick, which needs to be defined. A chola sheyesh bo sakana, somebody who anything is life-threatening, or even a chashash, even a possibility that something could become life-threatening because of fasting, has a chiv deraisa to eat. There's nothing to talk about. You know, no question that person should eat. A chola, who somebody, let's say, has the flu, you know, or something, you know, strep, who knows what. So one presumably should speak once again to a medical professional and to a rav who's familiar with the halachas, you know, how to define what's a halachic chola, but assuming it's not life-threatening, so if the person is halachically a chola, he also does not have to fast. Can he fast? This is an interesting question. The person wants to fast. It's not sakana safajas. We're talking about a case where he's spoken to a medical professional. The medical professional says, there's nothing usher to fast. I mean, from the medical perspective, there's nothing threatening. You'll be very uncomfortable. But, you know, if you want to, you could. If the doctor were to say that, can the person fast?
I mean, does it matter if it, let's say, it may prolong that strep throat or whatever? I mean, are you allowed to do that? Are you allowed to do that? I'm putting myself, I'm like prolonging.
You're addressing chavala, you know, as a person to basically afflict pain on himself, but he has a greater good. So generally, and I'm saying something very vague, and it really needs to be taken with better application for different situations, but generally, assuming the good outweighs the bad, then we all do that on a regular basis. I want to lose a few pounds. But Moshe actually has a truth about dieting. He's mechalic whether if I'm actually having hunger pangs, you know, like that it really is painful, or just I really want to eat, you know, but, you know, I really shouldn't because I need to lose a couple pounds. So I'm sacrificing something because I have a greater goal. We all pain ourselves to a degree, whether it's saving money or whatever it is, in order to get something. Exercise is not comfortable for most people. I know I don't like it. I try to do it regularly. Try, operative word. But at the same time, I know that it's a mitzvah, you know, to be in good health. To exercise appropriately is certainly, you know, a positive. But I'm even talking about when it's not even for health benefit. There are certain things that, you know, you go through a little pain, or I don't know if you want to call it discomfort, in order for a greater good. So there are limits. And this is definitely getting into elective surgeries and you know, plastic surgery and that kind of stuff for cosmetic reasons. Solely for cosmetic reasons. That's a major machlokas in the poskim. So I don't want to get into specifics. But at the same point in time, Maisa, the concept is at least not too foreign. So that being the case, the way it's worded, certainly in the Shulchan Aruch, is that cholim, fast was not said for chol. Now keep in mind, going back to the beginning of this year, and we discussed women somewhat briefly, and we discussed women now obviously with nursing and pregnant and all different scenarios, but besides the original fasts, the Chazal, or even pre-Chazal, depending on what you want to determine as Chazal, perhaps even in the Nevi'im, discussing as fast days, you know, even when it was for sure Zman Churban, etc. So then, it seems, it wasn't for Cholim. Certainly, with the acceptance that Klai Yisrael has, it's not for Cholim. So, can they fast? The answer, presumably, is if it doesn't pose a medical risk, yes, but they shouldn't think that they're fasting with a tzibur. It's a tainus yachid. It's the same thing if they'll fast tomorrow. There's a maisa that they tell with, I believe it's the Brisker Rav, I don't think it's Reb Chaim. I'm only chosha that it was Reb Chaim, because right now I'm going back and forth, but yeah, I'm pretty sure it was the Brisker Rav. If not, it was with Reb Chaim. That somebody went up to him and discussed the situation, that he had some sort of ailment, and it was before the fast. It was the day before the fast, and clearly this person was not getting better by the next day. So he said, do I have to fast? And the psak was, no, you're a chola, you do not have to fast. To which the person said, can I fast? To which the Briskra thought about it for a second and said, you can, but make sure to be mekabel tainus during mincha. Because on a tainus yachid, if you're not mekabel tainus the mincha before, then it's not chal. Which means that you're not part of the tzibur's fast. Now, in a situation where a person is not fasting, they certainly can say all the slichas, 100%. They're still, you know, calling out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to save us from the tzaras and to commemorate the different tzaras that have happened to us in the past. Just because they happen to not be fasting does not mean that they're not part of that. They cannot say Anenu in its full form. Now, from the straight reading of the poskim, a lot of times it just says you can't say Anenu. The Mishnah Berurah allows the person to say Biyom Tzom HaTanis instead of Biyom Tzom Taniseinu. So, that's a rishos. If the person wants to, we can say that. And then he can add Anenu into Shomea Tefillah. Such a person, however, should not daven for the Amud. Even if he's a chiyuv, he should not daven for the Amud. And he should not get an aliyah. A few years back, I remember it was Tzom Gedalia, I woke up and I had 101 fever, I think. It's the only time that I've not fasted on a tainus since my bar mitzvah that I can remember. Or since the year before my bar mitzvah, whatever it was. And, you know, I was not going to fast. And I remember we were still in the basement, we hadn't surfaced yet. I went and I looked around to see if there were any other Levi'im. Baruch Hashem there were, otherwise I would have walked out of the room when it came to that and had the coin due to Aliyahs. But I went to Mr. Wolf, who was then the Gabbai, and I said, I'm not sure who you're giving Levi to. Unfortunately, I'm not fasting, so just please don't call me. And that's the best thing, is that the person should approach the Gabbai, even if they don't suspect that they're going to get the Aliyah, because it's much more embarrassing, you know, to get called up and then something else to happen. Now, if they get called up already, that may be a different story because of embarrassment, what have you. But certainly the chadchila, this person should not be getting an aliyah, and we're not saying that there's anything wrong. I had no reason, nor even if I fasted, certainly based on that story we were just talking about, the Ma'aseh Rabbah we were just mentioning, had I fasted, I wouldn't have even been part of the fast because I wasn't mekabel the day before and I was sick.
So even though it happened already, let's say, on the fast day, and you weren't aware of it.
Yeah, I'm saying. The chola. So that's what, you know, what happened in that situation. Now, keep in mind, ubers and minikos, pregnant women and nursing women, it's even before they're at the level of chola. Because if they're a chola, you don't have to come on to the reason for ubra or manika. It's simply because they're a chola. And therefore, we're even talking about a different element, you know, of sickness. You know, it's discussed with Moshe the Tshuva about, you know, somebody who had to go to work. He knows if he goes to work, he has to go to work, he's going to end up having to eat. So, it's fasting anyway. And the idea behind it, really, he knows he can't keep up with it. He's too weak. He's a labor-intensive job, physically difficult. And he knows either he'll dehydrate or whatever it is. He'll come to a point where the guy's going to pass out and really be sick if he doesn't. So essentially, he was told, well, when you get to that point, you'll eat then. Now, you have to be careful. Because you don't not just be more hetter for things necessarily. A person is going to feel weak during a tarnas. There's no two ways about it. Chazal knew that. People weren't superhuman. Not everybody, I should say, was superhuman in the past. So, that being the case, the regular weakness and feelings of tinnitus, which, you know, different people react differently, a slight headache perhaps, you know, clammy hands, you know, whatever, we all feel. We all know what we feel personally, and I'm assuming everybody feels it slightly differently. That's not necessarily a chola, that's called going through a tinnitus. It's not supposed to be a pleasant experience. So you have to be magdir where the differences are. You know, they have medications and things now that are supposed to be time release, 24-hour things that people take before tinnitus. I've never taken them. I can't discuss whether they're effective or not. Is there anything wrong with them? Technically not. A person is doing something that it's, you know, when he's taking the medication, it's mutter. If a person, let's say, doesn't take it and goes through a tinnitus, and I think we've all had this also, where you go through a tinnitus and you didn't feel it one iota, you know, whatever it was that day. So, you know, it's weird. Sometimes on the shortest tinnitus I've had, it's the most difficult for me, and then the longer ones, it's, you know, whatever. Just I don't know why. Something with, you know, that's just how it is. The person doesn't have to feel it. You know, it's just the person isn't allowed to stop from feeling it if it's going. At the same point in time, I do strongly feel that it's circumventing the idea behind it. The idea is, not that you have to make yourself in pain, but the idea of the Torah was, or here, the Chachamim / Minhag, is that the person is supposed to be in a situation where, under normal circumstances, he'll probably start to feel something, and that feeling is really, to a degree, a good thing. You know, you're supposed to feel, you're supposed to feel some sorrow, it's supposed to allow you to take to heart what's really going on and what's really happened. And so, it's one thing if a person has exceptionally difficult tinnitus. I'm not talking about that at all. But somebody who doesn't have an exceptionally difficult tinnitus, for him or her to take such things, it's technically mutter. But I certainly think it's well not within the spirit of the law. Last thing, just to mention, as we're discussing with tinnitus, and I may repeat this on Shabbos, just because it's something that people are oftentimes interested in, there is a difference between these four tinnitus and Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur. And that is, can one brush their teeth? This is a common shaila that comes up almost every tinnitus. And the answer is, maybe. It depends. The discussion in the earlier poskim, before really teeth brushing, I need to ask my local dentist here, before that became popular as we know it, certainly with toothpaste, was for somebody to take water and to swish it around and then to spit it out. And the discussion is for somebody to do that while their head is facing somewhat downwards. That way they're not going to accidentally swallow it. They are allowed to do on these four tinnitus as long as it's a minimal amount of water, less than a rabbis perhaps. One is allowed to do that because we're not choshed that you're going to swallow it accidentally. It's also a minimal amount of water. But it's only if the person's mouth is really disturbing them. Now, disturbing them could mean several things. It could mean, number one, they have a really bad taste and it's really disturbing them. They have really bad breath and it's disturbing them. Or it's disturbing other people. Or they don't know if it's disturbing other people, but they're very self-conscious, so practically it's disturbing them, even though if physically nobody else can detect it. So that being the case, it's just as applicable brushing one's teeth, because also, when that choshed, you're going to swallow. It's not meant to be swallowed. Right? A similar halacha that goes with this, which Tzipas HaFrank, which most of the Velt is so mechon, its scope is not, has a non-kosher product in it. It has a glycerin in it, which is very probably non-kosher. What's the heter to rinse with scope? Truth is, I shouldn't say this definitively, it was this way about 8 years ago when I looked into it. So I don't think they've changed it. Listerine doesn't have that. So why do I go with scope when I should go with Listerine? The answer is, Rav Pesach Frank says, there's a din that the Taz brings, actually, in Taruvas, that I could stick my tongue out and touch something that's suffix is, sir, because it's not going in my mouth, there's no chashash, I'm going to swallow it. But I can't put it in my mouth, because there's a chashash, I'm going to swallow it. So over here, I know, let's assume it's not suffix, which with scope it may be suffix is, sir. But nevertheless, the nature of the product is meant to be spit out. So not choshed that I'm going to swallow. The little bit that, you know, just happens, the taste of it going down, that's not really swallowing necessarily. You're not machshed that as an achila, you're just having a taste. But you have to be machshed to try to spit as much out as you can. So the same thing applies to toothpaste. You know, he's talking from a kasher standpoint, certainly for a tinus standpoint. So we're not choshed, you're going to swallow it. So one is, once again, only if there's tsar being defined as discomfort, psychological or physical tsar, one is allowed to brush his or her teeth on these four tanaisim. That does not apply to Yom Kippur or Tisha B'Av. Okay.